It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about an in-depth report on the hazards of alcohol-related falls for Wisconsin seniors. Our guest says it's a big problem here in the state. First, Wisconsin has more than 6,000 rape kits that need to be tested, and the state's backlog of untested rape kits could include more than 2,000 that could be related to crimes against minors. This info comes from ongoing research being conducted by the State Department of Justice. It was released following requests from the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Keegan Kyle is with us. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Keegan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We've talked to you, Keegan, about this backlog of untested information, evidence. Let's start with the big news now out of this records request. What do we see about who was affected, who these crimes were potentially committed against?
Well, we learned that more than 2,000 of the 6,000 kits came from children. That's never been any part of discussion to date about these kits. We've known very little, actually, about the demographics of who submitted evidence to law enforcement agencies and hospitals, in some cases more than decades ago, and their evidence was never submitted to state crime labs until recently.
And what do we know about why these 2,000-plus kits never got tested?
Like with adult kits, a lot of evidence didn't get tested because of local law enforcement decisions. So local police agencies decided not to pursue investigations, and so they didn't submit evidence for testing. Or local prosecutors decided not to pursue charges, or they dismissed their cases. In a lot of other instances, prosecutors decided that testing the evidence would not impact their investigation or help them seek criminal charges. So if, you know, for example, if a suspect already confessed to a crime, then they wouldn't send evidence for testing. In less often, but still hundreds of cases, evidence wasn't sent to state labs because the people who supplied the evidence didn't want to report a sexual assault to law enforcement, or they didn't want to pursue criminal charges, or local law enforcement labeled them as uncooperative. And so for those reasons, a lot of evidence wasn't sent for testing either.
A lot of people seem to be saying that's not okay. More of these kits, maybe not all of them, but more of them should have been tested earlier on. Is that right?
Yeah, the state plans to test at least 4,000 of these kits and possibly more depending on how investigations develop. Most of the evidence that's scheduled to be tested are those cases where law enforcement chose not to pursue investigations long ago. But in a lot of cases, some of those cases in which law enforcement had previously determined allegations were unfounded, that evidence in some cases is also now being sent for testing in labs.
We're talking to Keegan Kyle from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at the state's backlog of untested rape kits. New information shows that about a third of those rape kits involved minors, potential crimes against minors. Keegan, we've been talking to you about this issue for a while. Talk about the state of Wisconsin's efforts to catch up with this backlog.
Sure. This is going to by the State Department of Justice is kind of overseeing this effort to test a lot of this evidence. They received grants from both the federal government and New York prosecutors to ship a lot of the state's evidence to private labs to have it testing. But that's going to take a long time for those results to come back. They plan to schedule about 200 kits per month, and they started earlier this year. So we're looking at, you know, all the thousands of kits will not be done testing until sometime next year and possibly later, depending on how the scheduling goes. I should say the testing could also be done sooner if private labs are able to handle a higher capacity and they're able to process more evidence quickly.
Is it the hope that testing more of these kits might find DNA matches with other maybe unsolved sexual assaults?
Exactly. The idea of testing all of this evidence is to try to identify people who have eluded justice, to try to piece together serial offenders And that's shown to happen in other states such as Michigan. Detroit went through a very large amount of evidence similar to this and identified a bunch of offenders out of it. Wisconsin is hoping to do something similar to identify people who've somehow eluded justice to date.
And you mentioned earlier that some of these were never tested because authorities, often local police or prosecutors, didn't pursue a report of sexual assault, believe that the case was unfounded or that the victim, alleged victim, was uncooperative. Is that seen as a problem that maybe we're not investigating reported sexual assaults closely enough?
Yeah, that's still a little unclear about how much of this evidence is related to, you know, poor investigations long ago. In some documents, in some grant documents, state authorities have cited concerns over law enforcement training and kind of the inability of law enforcement to recognize signs of trauma as being uncooperative or untruthful. So the idea being that if a survivor of rape or sexual assault changes their story, law enforcement might wrongly assume that the person is lying, when in fact they might just be exhibiting symptoms of trauma. So those types of understandings now about what victims go through have changed the mindset about how to investigate sexual assault. And so they're reconsidering, maybe revisiting some of these cases to look for those types of shortcomings in past investigations.
Looking at this, these 6,000 plus untested rape kits overall, what time period are these from?
They stretch back at least 2 decades, according to state authorities, but I don't personally know the exact date range. All the kits are pre-2015, though. For the past couple of years, the state says it has been able to keep up with all sexual assault evidence submitted to state labs, and it's tried to make sure that a new backlog like this does not accumulate. The backlog itself is all older cases stretching back at least 2 years, but in some cases more than a decade.
Now, these untested kits, you just obtained information that hadn't been out in the public eye about the age range of the alleged victims in these crimes attached to these rape kits. Do we know things like where around the state they were, what police departments might have been involved in the decision to test or not to test?
We don't know specifically, where the child kits came from in the state. The State Department of Justice redacted that type of information from the records that we requested. So we also can't pinpoint answers to questions like which police agencies determined that these sexual assaults were unfounded or which prosecutors decided not to press charges after receiving this evidence. We can't answer those questions because of state redaction. We do know broadly just that most of the 6,000 kits come from urban law enforcement agencies around the state. But again, we don't know kind of the details for each agency.
I understand one other reason that some kits were not tested was to protect the victim's privacy if they didn't decide to press charges. How common is that as a cause of an untested kit?
It's relatively uncommon compared to other reasons. In almost two-thirds of cases, law enforcement decided not to pursue an investigation, or a prosecutor believed that testing evidence wouldn't be helpful. It's only in about a third or less of cases that a victim or a survivor really had a role in determining that evidence would not be sent to a state lab.
As we wrap up, Keegan, you've been following this story for quite a while. What information don't we know that you would like to know about this backlog of untested kits?
We feel like some of the information that was redacted from us, we'd certainly like to see that because it would help us determine which of these agencies we need to talk to about their sexual assault investigation practices. You know, whether there have been more recent changes or whether the practices that produced this backlog are still happening today. Those are things things that we'd really like to check on, but we just don't have the information. We'd also like to learn a lot more about more personal experiences about reporting a sexual assault and what it is like from the survivor's perspective to go through the process. That's really something that we haven't written about recently, and we'd be interested in hearing from victims on that.
Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about the backlog of untested rape kits in Wisconsin and how more than 2,000 of those kits could be related to crimes against minors. Coming up, alcohol-related falls are a big and growing problem for seniors here in Wisconsin. We'll find out why coming up on Central Time. Falling down can be a major health risk for seniors, with a simple fall potentially causing injuries that require long-term medical care. There's growing attention to the problem, and there are efforts to help prevent falls in the first place. It's a nationwide problem, but Wisconsin has a particularly high risk because of alcohol-related falls. Peter Kuchu wrote an in-depth piece on alcohol-related falls for the Capital Times, where he's a special assignment intern. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, does Wisconsin stand out when it comes to alcohol-related falls for seniors?
Wisconsin absolutely stands out when it comes to alcohol-related fatal falls for senior citizens, and just because it kind of brings together two of Wisconsin's worst health problems to a culmination, the really elevated drinking rates as well as the already elevated falling rates.
And let's look at seniors here in Wisconsin. As you write in your piece, mm-hmm. people know we drink a lot in Wisconsin. We have a drinking problem in the population as a whole. What do we see from senior citizens in Wisconsin when it comes to alcohol?
So I don't think Wisconsin's ever been shy about kind of almost boasting at times about the drinking rates that are prevalent throughout the state. And seniors see an interesting trend. They're starting to drink more and more when compared to like a decade ago. And throughout Wisconsin, a lot of other age groups their drinking rates have stayed about the same or have actually improved a little bit. So that trend with Wisconsin seniors drinking more than ever is fairly concerning, especially when it relates to alcohol-related fatal falls.
Yeah, we'll get back to falls. I mean, that seems like it could be a whole nother story in itself, why alcohol rates, alcohol abuse is rising among seniors. Did any of the experts you talked to speculate as to why that might be?
It was tough, and I didn't have any experts really give a concrete answer or an answer they felt very confident in, just because it's something that hasn't been studied too much. When people talk about alcohol use throughout the state, I think people typically focus more on like drunk driving and those deaths that are more highly publicized and a bit more could be deemed a bit more tragic by some people versus senior citizens. They drink more in their house typically. I heard that echoed a lot. It's not as public, and it's something that doesn't really affect other people than themselves too much.
But you write that when we look at fatality rates, do I have this right? These alcohol-related falls actually cause more fatalities than drunk driving over the last handful of years?
Mm-hmm. These alcohol-related fatal falls just among senior citizens well outpace the rate of drunk driving deaths throughout all populations in the state of Wisconsin. I think that gap emerged in 2008, and since then it's just become wider and wider.
And then seniors are especially vulnerable to what alcohol does to people, right? Mm-hmm. For a couple of reasons, it sounds like. What do we know about that?
So I had a few experts talk to me just about how it's a natural part of aging that people's bones become weaker, they have less muscle mass and stuff like that would help reduce the risk that comes with alcohol use. And so seniors, it's a natural part of aging to have those effects, but it's not a natural part of aging to have those injuries sustained through falls that comes with an increased rate of drinking.
Right, and that's something that a lot of the experts you talked to, it sounds like, said, yeah, we hear about falls in seniors. It is not a natural part of aging. It is a preventable problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an injury. It's a really, really prevalent injury. I think among the 65 and older population, it's the number one cause of injury-related fatalities throughout the state. But it is absolutely preventable, and this wasn't mentioned in the story, but I saw some very targeted approaches in specific counties throughout Wisconsin when there were certain programs or educational materials released that targeted falls, there was actually a drop in falls in following years. So it seems kind of like when there are these approaches that really try to target falls, the rate of falls do decline.
And then another angle, it sounds like, is who's more likely to be taking various kinds of prescription medication. Mm-hmm. Seniors, is that part of the problem when it comes to alcohol making falls more likely?
I think absolutely. And the expert I talked to about that, specifically David Mott, the rate of just how often medication plays a factor isn't that well documented among falls. It's just it's hard to document for the same reasons alcohol is hard to document with precise figures. But that really could be a story on its own to the how medication affects seniors just because they're prescribed so much medication right now.
We're talking to Peter Kuchu about a piece he wrote for the Capital Times on alcohol-related falls here in Wisconsin. We in the state have a particular problem compared to the rest of the nation when it comes to alcohol-related falls and fatalities from those falls. I want to put a face on this a little bit, Peter. You start off your piece with a story about someone who'd had this happen to them in central Wisconsin, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. In central Wisconsin, and used some anonymous sourcing for that because mm-hmm. family members were concerned about just telling that story publicly.
Sure.
and in that community. But When speaking to that source, they always really stressed how vital they thought it was to get this story out, to tell this story, just because of the effect it's had on them, on their family, and how difficult it is for seniors at times to talk about this kind of thing. It's so prevalent among seniors, falls that result in fatalities and falls that result in hospitalization and injuries. But there, it really does seem that there's an aversion to talking about it.
And this was a guy who every day after retirement went out to work in the shed or the shop out mm-hmm. back and spent the day drinking brandy or whiskey, which was fine until the day it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah, he was a handyman in central Wisconsin. He was a machinist his entire working career, and really proud of that fact, proud of the fact that he went to work every day. And when he retired, he didn't really have anything to fill that gap. And that's not unique to, mm-hmm. to his situation. That's a common reason why seniors can start drinking a bit more. And in this case, it had nearly fatal results for this person. And in the future, I've heard that concern that the next fall could be worse. It could result in more serious consequences.
This is a problem that isn't going to get better without effort, it sounds like. I mean, there's a couple natural reasons. We're getting older here in Wisconsin. We've got an aging population, for one thing. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, our 65 and older population is set to boom over the next two decades. I think right now it's about 770,000 people throughout the state, and by 2040 it's going to double. So if we keep up with our current rate, we're going to see hundreds of more deaths each year from this type of injury, and if the rate keeps increasing that it is, we're going to see possibly thousands a year.
I want to get into some solutions now. You mentioned there are programs around the state targeted at preventing falls, and we've talked to some of the people doing that here on the show. Are they focusing on alcohol specifically in those efforts that you've seen?
So I haven't seen too much focus specifically in Wisconsin on alcohol. I talked to a few different people from Hazelden, the treatment center that has stations in, I think the big ones are Minnesota and Naples, but in some other states too, and they focus more on alcohol. And it's difficult. What I heard from a lot of people is that it's difficult to create messaging to address seniors drinking, just because it's a population that isn't typically reached, and it's difficult to lecture seniors. It feels like lecturing someone that's older, that's wiser than you, and it just comes across kind of, what I heard from experts, it can come across as preachy sometimes if it's not done really, really carefully.
But part of the effort might be doing what you're doing in this piece, sharing the story, like the family you mentioned wanted to. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things, like mental illness used to be more so. It's happening, it's killing people, and nobody's talking about it.
I think that's definitely an element of it. Not mention this piece, I talked to a coroner from a Wisconsin county who I was talking to him about, and he's really involved with recovery-based education in his county. And when I read him the numbers, he was astounded. He said he wanted to get to work on educational materials for his county and to start going to senior centers to speak to that. And I think that's as people become more and more aware of these type of falls, that's going to happen more and more.
Right. I think if you ask me, hey, Rob, we need you to start a binge drinking awareness program, what population are you going to start with? I would think kids, college kids, college age kids. This is an overlooked group, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, when I first heard the term alcohol-related fatal falls, I thought of a college senior like falling off of a balcony or off of a dock. I didn't think of someone who's 70 years old who had four drinks and stumbling and falling and breaking their hip. That's just, it's not the image that comes to mind, I don't think. But it's what happens.
Now, what if I can dig into the journalism here, what led you to this story? Because this is something I haven't seen covered anywhere else.
So it's mostly from reading a few other stories that had, when I saw in-depth reports on falls, and there is some, there's an element of alcohol that can be mentioned, but it's not until one of the last few paragraphs. It's really at the bottom, and I kind of thought that there was a big story in that element, and I just really tried to dig to that, and I saw in another article someone mentioning, I think it was Julius Sherman, who I actually reached out and quoted pretty extensively, talking about how seniors are drinking more now, and I looked up the rates and the fall numbers, and I was just astounded, and I figured a lot of other people would be too if they saw those.
Definitely. So what is your next step? Are you going to keep covering this? And what angles are you pursuing, if so?
So I have a couple more stories in the work for the Cap Times on this. One specifically focusing on cost. I think cost is a huge factor in this. Falls cost so much to the state, as well as excessive drinking. I think the last year I saw numbers for 2012, and that was about excessive drinking of all populations cost about $6.8 billion. A lot of that was burdened on taxpayers. And then falls nationwide, I think, cost some $34 billion the last year that was available. I think DHS, Department of Health Services in Wisconsin, is actually working on a new report specifically about falls that can give more accurate estimates just of how much money this is costing Wisconsin.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Peter Kuchu, special assignment intern for the Capital Times. He wrote about alcohol-related falls and the risks facing seniors in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, we talk about the ever-present role of technology in the lives of young people and how it can affect everything from their social lives to mental health. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Young people born in the mid-1990s and on are the first generation to spend their entire adolescence in the age of the smartphone. As our next guest writes, they likely had an Instagram page before they started high school and don't remember a time before the internet. But how has that access to technology affected their lives, and what does that mean for their future and ours? Jean Twenge is a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. Her new book is called iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's start off with that term, iGen. Talk about who these people are, what this generation is.
Yeah, so it's iGen with a little I, like iPods and iPhones. About two-thirds or so of teens today own not just a smartphone, but actually an iPhone. So it's a label that makes a lot of sense. Some people have called this group Gen Z, but if the millennials just before them are not Gen Y, Gen Z doesn't make a lot of sense. So iGen is those born roughly between 1995 and 2012.
And you really focus on the role of that technology, the impact that having access to social media, the internet, from a very early age has on people. Why is that such a key factor?
Well, iGen is really the first generation to spend their teen years with smartphones. So by most surveys, the average teen spends 6 to 8 hours a day with a screen. If you include TV, it goes up to almost 10. So that's just in leisure time. That has had a really big effect on the rest of their lives. It really has ripple effects on how they socialize and their mental health and so on. So for one thing, teens are communicating with their friends so much through their phones that they're spending less time with their friends in person across, no matter what you ask about, whether it's just hanging out with friends, going to parties, going to the mall, going to the movies. iGen teens do those things less often than teens did just 10 years ago.
And you write that this isn't all bad. A lot of times when people talk about a new generation, it's what's wrong with insert name of generation here. You see positives and negatives.
Yeah, you know, I think when you think about generations and cultural change overall, it is very tempting for people to see things in terms of, oh, yeah, what's wrong with them, or let's criticize them, or whose fault is it? But you really miss the big picture when you do that, because, of course, there's some changes that are good, some that are bad, some that are neither one. So it really makes a lot of sense to try to see the whole picture. So there's just one example. Yes, teens are spending a lot of time on their phones and less time with people in person. That's probably not the best trend, but they're also physically safer, and they're more concerned with safety. They're probably the safest generation in American history. The homicide rate for young people is very low. They don't fight physically with each other as much as previous generations did. They're better drivers and get in fewer accidents. So there's a lot of positive trends with this group as well.
One of the most worrisome things, though, and I think about this as a parent of kids in this generation, you write that on the whole, they seem to be less happy than previous generations were at the same age. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so I've been doing this work looking at generational differences for about 25 years, and I keep an eye on these really large national surveys that are done of teens every year. Right around 2012, I started to see a spike in teens reporting symptoms of depression. And other surveys started to see this too. Big increases in the level of clinical level depression. The suicide rate started to go up. Teens became more likely to say that they felt lonely and left out. And then a year or two later, happiness started to slide and life satisfaction. So all of these signs of teens are telling us that they're not particularly happy, and that happened right around the same time that the percentage of Americans with a smartphone crossed 50%. Of course, it's hard to say that one causes the other, but it's an awfully suspicious pattern.
But you lay out research on a number of behaviors and their link with happiness, and we see increases in the ones that you say tend to make us less happy, more time online, more time on social media, and at the same time decreases in communal activities, whether that's going out and playing a sport with other people or hanging out with friends or going to parties or going to church, you name it. We're doing more of the unhappy stuff and less of the stuff that makes us happy.
Yeah, so that's one of the other great things about these surveys of thousands and thousands of teens is they're asked not just if they're happy, but how they spend their time. And if you look at those correlations, pretty much everything you would do with a screen, whether that's TV or these newer activities like texting, social media, being online, those correlate with being more unhappy. Pretty much anything you do that's not on a screen that a teen would do with his or her leisure time, like hanging out with their friends, joining religious services, sports and exercise, sleep, all of those things are connected to more happiness. So, of course, that's correlational. So it's possible, say, that unhappy teens are more likely to spend more time on screens and less time with people in person. But there's a couple studies that more or less rule out that explanation. Two, for example, follow people over time and found that more social media use led to more unhappiness, so more unhappiness didn't lead to more social media use.
Talking to Jean Twenge. Her new book is called iGen. It looks at the generation of people born starting in the mid-1990s, their relationship to technology, how it's changing their lives. You also write, it's in the title of the book, and you've got a chapter on it, people in this generation tend to be more tolerant. What do we know about that, and why is that?
Yeah, so if you look at iGen teens and young adults today compared to teens, say, 20 years ago, so say Gen Xers, you really see a pronounced pattern that young people today are more likely to, say, be supportive of mothers working. They're more likely to say that they want to support rights based on race and gender and sexual orientation. Sexual orientation in particular has a very pronounced generational shift that still exists today, because on a lot of these attitudes, older people have changed too, and attitudes around sexual orientation are no exception to that. But that's where iGen and younger millennials just before them really stand out, that there's still a pronounced generation gap when it comes to issues like same-sex marriage. And a lot of iGeners won't even remember a time before same-sex marriage was legal. They take sexual orientation for granted. They say that they believe people should be who they are. And for them, that's kind of a bedrock sense of equality that they really take for granted.
One thing you write that struck me was that in studying previous generations, you see changes usually happening slowly and gradually over time. And this one seems different. You see, and a lot of the charts in your books look like this. There's this gradual trend, and all of a sudden, boom, the bottom falls out of whatever the measure is. What do you make of that, the suddenness of the change in so many different categories?
Yeah, I have never seen that before, really. So take this data, goes from boomers to Gen Xers to millennials. There were certainly generational changes, but they tended to happen over the course of 5 years or 10 years, and they would keep building. But yeah, with iGen, right around those born about 1995, so those who are about 17 in 2012, there's these sudden breaks. Those trends toward not spending as much time with your friends, those millennials started, but then there's a really sharp drop-off around that time. And with mental health, at least on some measures, millennials were showing downward trends too. But with iGen, all of them end up going in the same direction very suddenly, right around 2011 or 2012.
When I see generational research, I always wonder, you know, I know these are averages, these are trends, but do the same rules apply for people, say, rich and poor, urban, rural, by different races, things like that? Looking at this iGen generation, how do you sort that out?
Yeah, so for the most part, these trends that we're discussing show up among teens of every background, every region of the country. Different socioeconomic status, whether they're advantaged or disadvantaged, race and ethnicity, gender. Most of these trends appear across all of those groups. Now, there's a couple of notable exceptions. The mental health trends are negative for both boys and girls, but they're much more negative for girls. The trend line is much more pronounced for girls suffering more than boys. And then in terms of religion, which is one of the other things that I looked at, the trends for black teens are not as stark. They haven't changed as much as, say, white teens in their religious affiliation and beliefs.
One thing I should point out is your book isn't just about survey data. You actually interviewed a bunch of people in this generational group. And it's interesting, you know, we think of kids attached to their screens, and they are, but they feel really ambivalent about it, it sounds like, when you actually talk to them.
Yeah, so that's what's interesting, because, of course, you know, the bedrock of the conclusions is these surveys of, you know, 11 million young people, nationally representative, and so on, but they only ask certain questions, and they can't always get really in-depth. So I tried to get more in-depth with some open-ended questions from some surveys and with, really in-depth interviews with about 25 of them, either face-to-face or on the phone. And that was something that surprised me, was the number of young people said, no, we actually really would rather be with our friends in person. And it just is so much more emotionally fulfilling, which, of course, is the research completely backs them up. And even, say, one 13-year-old who I talked to, who's literally never known not only a world without the Internet, but can't remember a time before there were smartphones. And she completely saw the downsides of this approach. She talked about her drama teacher telling them, we're going to put our phones away so we can look people in the eye. She told me about it when a friend of hers, when they were hanging out, her friend was looking at her phone and how that hurt, that her friend wasn't paying attention to her and was looking at the screen. So it was very interesting to me that teens, even young ones, they see the downsides of this. It's just that social media and those phones, they feel mandatory to them, and they're also addictive. That's a whole other piece we haven't talked about.
We'll get into that. We're talking with Gene Twenge, author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She says there's a big generational shift with young people born starting in the mid-1990s, a lot of it involved with that attachment to various kinds of digital devices. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you are in this generation, people born in the mid-90s or later, we'd especially love to hear from you. How has technology shaped your life? Do you love it, hate it, you're attached to it, but wish you could spend less time on it? Do you spend time, real time, in person with other people and people of other generations, maybe parents and grandparents? What differences do you see between your generation and that of younger people? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about technology and its impact on the lives of young people. Jean Twenge is with us. Her new book is called iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Are you a member of this iGen, the generation born starting in the mid-90s? How do you think the members of iGen differ from previous generations? How do you think this generation of young people will shape our culture? What do you think of the technology that they've grown up with, that you've grown up with? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Kelly is on the line in Madison. Kelly, hi.
Hi. I'm the mother of three teenagers, and I think that they are exposed to so much more of what is going on in the world, so they are so much more aware of things that are going on than our generation was, and they see a lot of the really terrible things that are happening, and they really don't understand why there's problems like there are. And, you know, like racism and problems with, LGBT and all of that. Because for them, they are taking that for granted because that's the way it's always been. I'm always talking to them about women's rights because in my lifetime, women did have problems, a lot of sexist stuff. And they just don't understand that because they don't think that's the way it should be.
Kelly, thanks for calling in. That connection between exposure to a lot of bad news, Gene, and unhappiness. I mean, as a grown-up, I feel that. And so what's it like for kids growing up with that constant exposure to whatever the news is, however bad it might be?
Well, you know, based on these surveys and the teens that I talk to, that doesn't seem to be the average experience. Teens today are actually a little less interested in following the news. They're less interested in government and in social issues, say especially than boomers were in the 70s, but even a little less than Gen Xers were. In the interviews that I did, when I asked teens, you know, what do you do online, it was almost always communicating with friends, entertainment. Most of them, several of them didn't even know that there was such a thing as Google News or Apple News. That was a surprise to them. So, and that fits what the national surveys show, which is that's not the primary thing that they're doing on their phones. The vast majority of it is communication and entertainment.
Kelly, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Nick in West Allis. Nick, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Nick?
So I have a bachelor's of science in computer science and a minor in information technology. I was born in 1993 and I'm a recent graduate. So my experience throughout my life is that people didn't really understand my interest in technology. And, you know, they always thought of me as like the computer guy and I could help them with all their computer needs. And it was a unique position within my family. And I felt like that it was really beneficial for me to kind of learn how to figure out problems and use technology in my own way to help other people around me. And it gave me an opportunity, as well as creating groups and social groups. I have a YouTube channel that I stream to where I am with a community of people that I help affect their lives in a positive way. So me growing up with technology has given me that opportunity, whereas if I didn't have it, I might not know that that possibility can exist to help people.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, right on the cusp of iGen, it sounds like, Gene, but does his story sound familiar?
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm glad he brought up some of the many advantages of these technologies, that they really do keep us connected, that you can find people who are interested in the things that you're interested in. There's a lot of big advantages to this technology, and it kind of echoes some of the research findings that the teens who are not connected using technology at all, they're not actually particularly happy. The sweet spot for happiness is moderate use, so up to about 2 hours or so a day is actually beneficial. After that, that's when you start to get more unhappiness, more of these mental health effects. So the solution isn't to yank the phone out of, you know, every teen's hand, especially the older ones. It's to limit the amount of use. And I think that's excellent advice for adults as well. Yeah, you know, use these technologies for what they're great for, but try not to get addicted and try to have it not be something that is a compulsion and, you know, in your hand 6 to 8 hours a day like the average is for teens.
Nick, thanks for that call. We're talking to Jean Twenge. Her new book is iGen. It's about the younger generation and their connection to technology for better and for worse. Back to your calls now with Rose on the line in Milwaukee. Rose, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Rose?
Well, I was born in 1990, and I remember growing up in a world where we knew how to be bored. We weren't outside with, I mean, we had Game Boys, we had video games, but the internet, you know, dial-up, all that came around when I was in high school. So I guess my main concern is, you know, we don't know how to communicate face-to-face. We don't remember a lot of things, and we rely on our cell phones for learning. There's a lot that I don't retain anymore. I don't know my friends' phone numbers. I'm trying to build up my vocabulary.
Rose, your line's breaking up a little bit there, but a lot of points there. Jean, I want to get to that point you mentioned about forgetting how to communicate face-to-face. That is a concern you raise in the book.
It is, and we really need a lot more research on this because that's one of the main worries people have right now. Social skills get better with practice, and iGen is having less practice because they're spending less time with their friends face-to-face. So they may be developing, you know, knowledge about the right emoji to use, but maybe not the right facial expression. So we really do need to find out if that is the case, if their social skills have been affected. There's one small study that suggests maybe it will be. It took sixth graders, and half of them went to a screen-free camp for 5 days, and the other half didn't. And those who went to the screen-free camp improved their ability to read emotions on others' faces more than those who didn't go to the camp. So that we need more of those studies, but that points in the direction of some potential issues around social skills.
Rose, thanks for that call. As we start to wrap up, Jean, one solution you offer for parents is, hey, put off that phone as long as you can, make it a dumber phone as long as you can. But I wonder about media literacy. You mentioned the concept that, you know, these sites, the social media, it's built with the intention of being addictive. Do kids need to be brought up knowing that, hey, these sites are not charities there for your benefit, they're making money off of your attention?
I think that's a great message for kids to understand that, yeah, these social media companies, they make more money the longer people are on them, and that, you know, their main purpose is advertising, that's really what they're there for. And it really is an issue of moderation, that if they want to set up things with their friends using a social media site, maybe they can do it on a laptop or a desktop. It doesn't necessarily have to be on a phone with no restrictions. So the average age for getting a smartphone these days is 10. And I think it would be much better if we waited longer than that until kids were a little more emotionally ready and able to handle that potentially addicting nature of the smartphone.
Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jean Twenge. She's the author of the new book, iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She joins us to talk about what she calls the iGen generation, people born after the mid-90s, how they differ from previous generations, how they'll change our culture. Still time for you to share your thoughts, by the way. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, whatever device you might happen to be on. Let us know if this is you, if you're one of the iGen generation. What do you think about what our guest had to say? I got a press release today that I actually look forward to from the National Toy Hall of Fame with their annual list of new nominees. The Hall of Fame currently includes 63 classic toys and games, from Barbie to Big Wheels, Legos to Lincoln Logs, and Teddy Bears and Twister. Here's the list of the new nominees: Clue, the game, the Magic 8-Ball, Matchbox cars, My Little Pony, paper airplanes, Pez candy dispensers, play food, Risk, sand, Transformers, Uno, and the Wiffle Ball. Producer J. Carlisle Larson has a favorite in that list. Hey, JC.
I do. If I could throw all of my support behind one, I think I would definitely go with the paper airplane, which is, you know, I don't know why I gravitated to that, but that is what I would choose.
It's a classic. I meant to get some paper in here. People know that during pledge drives, when we have lots of extra pieces of paper around the studio, I will make, you know, paper airplanes during news breaks and things like that and surprise people.
Oh, I'm familiar.
I've gotten books about how to make cool, complicated paper airplanes, and I can't do them. Have you ever tried that?
So I used to have software that would teach me how to do
it.
And so,
like origami software for paper planes.
Yeah, and so I don't know if that makes me really cool or really sad, but I used to do that as a tween, I suppose, would be the age group that I would be in at the time.
In elementary school, I failed cutting, pasting, and folding, so it's not for me. Share your paper plane memories and Twitter @CentralTimeWPR. Thanks, JC.
Thank you.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.